When you buy LG, you get so much more than just an appliance. You get more done, more cost savings, more peace of mind, and more control. Because LG appliances are designed to do more. Like washers and dryers with AI tech to take out the guesswork, refrigerators that fit in tight spaces and keep food fresher longer, or ranges with precise induction cooking and easy cleanup built in, all with the style you want and reliability you can count on, so you can get more from your home every day. LG appliances, so much more. Make life easier with LG. See the latest models and savings now at LG.com.
88% of the workweek is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly, enterprise ready AI.
To me, art in general, however you define that, whether it's painting or music, it's the only thing that to me can make you think, it can make you smile, it can make you cry, it can make you have these moments. And I think in society today in general, with social media, we can be so detached yet connected. It's this weird thing, but to me, live music is still the tried and true. Seeing something in person is just the tried and true connection with another human being. And that's, you know, you can't replicate that. You just can't. And that's why I don't think live music will ever die, is because, or going to see paintings will ever die, or going to see, you know, theater will not die, because that is, we all search for that. No matter who we are, no matter what our belief system is, we all search for that, whatever it is.
Welcome to the Deconstructionist Podcast, everybody. We've got a very special episode for you today. I don't remember much of it.
Why is that, Adam?
Because we've been getting some reviews here and there on iTunes that I get a little carried away. I get a little excited. And in order to make sure that didn't happen on this very important interview, we are all set. We are all ready to go. Our notes out. We are ready to interview this guy. I was bouncing in my seat. John was getting nervous. He pulled out from his pocket an African blow dart, shot me in the neck. I collapsed into a pile of happiness and did not participate in the interview that ensued.
Yeah. Yep. My African blow dart that I keep next to my globe on my bookshelf.
He's deadly accurate with that thing.
Oh, man. Well, where were you really?
I was in training for my new job. I was out of town and I could not make this interview, even though it would have been a dream come true. I'm glad that our acting CEO, John Williamson here of the Deconstructionist Inc., was able to conduct this interview, and I'm just glad I even get to be on the intro and outro.
Well, the reality isn't much less ridiculous, because in reality you were training and flying on airplanes, and I was sending you custom memes.
Oh, it was so much fun.
So that will never see the light of day.
Oh, no.
People might question our Christian badges.
No.
Oh, but, goodness.
Yeah. So anybody that doesn't like my over bro-ness, tune in to this episode.
Adam's very quiet during this episode. Oh, man. But this is one of those episodes that, for those of you that, you know, the heady academic ones are a little too much for you. And you really like just a good story, and you enjoyed our talks with the musicians last season, like the Derek Wett episode, Brendan Strawn, K-Max, you know, episodes like that. This is another musician. His name is Paul Janeway. He happens to be the lead singer of what I think is probably one of the best bands out there right now. They are a six-piece soul band from Birmingham, Alabama. They released an EP called Greetings from St. Paul and the Broken Bones, a live EP, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, live and in person, and then two full-length albums, Half the City, back in 2014, and then more recently, this last fall, they released one of my favorite albums, period, and Adam's been rocking out to it on vinyl, called Sea of Noise in the fall of 2016. And
the vinyl is transcendently good.
Who do you think he sounds like?
I don't know, because I love that Otis Redding record that you got me. It's kind of in that same kind of vein of like a Marvin Gaye, Otis Redding, like...
Yeah.
Just that huge
Al Green.
Yes, Al Green, absolutely. And it's beyond good. I mean, just I've been a huge fan for years now. So this is having them on the Deconstructionist podcast, or having Paul, I mean, wow.
What's your favorite track off that album, by the way?
I love just the intro track so much, but probably track two, to be honest, is my favorite. I mean, I can listen to it over and over and over. I don't know track names because it's on vinyl, so it's not like staring at me in the face.
yeah.
But track two, so good. But the whole album is good.
Oh, Flow With It. Yeah.
Flow With It is amazing.
Yeah. I got to agree. Crumbling Light Post Part One, that intro is just so pretty. I think Brain Matter is one of my favorites, and Burning Rome to me sounds just like Otis Redding.
Oh, and then the Is It Me?
Yeah,
like that ballad. Oh,
it's
so
incredible.
Good, so good. And well, just getting to hear his story just makes listening to the music that much more fun.
Yeah. He you'll find that he has a very interesting backstory, which is it'll become readily apparent why we really wanted to get him as a guest on the show. And so he talks a lot about his upbringing and kind of what led him into music and kind of how really interesting story about how he's using music now. To make a difference in his community, in his city, in the world, and just a real interesting guy. Just could not have been a nicer dude, and just kind of how he views the world is just really interesting and kind of refreshing, you know, to see a guy who has been opening for the Rolling Stones and playing in these giant stadiums be so incredibly humble and generous with his time, and just again could not have been a nicer, more generous dude.
No way. So
yeah, let's get to it, man.
Without further ado,
Paul freaking Janeway from St. Paul and the Broken Bones. Paul Janeway, we've been very, very excited. This has been a long time coming. I know we've had to reschedule a couple times due to unforeseen circumstances, but we are very, very excited to have you on the show. Welcome to the Deconstructionist podcast.
Ah, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. One of the things that we like to do, one of the questions that we like to ask a lot of the people that we have on the show, we get a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds. We've had, you know, scientists on and musicians previously and authors, bloggers. But the one thing that we always find that's really interesting is how people came to fall into the line of work that they do. And I think you've got a really interesting background and your story, I think, is really interesting. So maybe we could start there. If you could tell the listeners a little bit about, you know, kind of where you're from, how
you're
raised.
How far back do we want to go? Back do we want to go?
I think the interesting part of your story, though, to give you a little specific direction to go, is you as a youth up until, you were, I believe if I read this correctly, 19 years old, had actually considered going into seminary.
So I grew up in rural Alabama, grew up in a church that was considered non-denominational. So it would swing several different ways. But one of the predominant swings was a very charismatic, kind of healing and speaking in tongues and the whole shebang. I call it fun church and yeah. entertaining. And anyway, and so till I was a pretty good kid, you know. If the church doors are open, I was in there. I would. Goodness, I was a janitor there at one time. I mean, I did everything I could, and I you kind of fall in love with that. And because really, in a small town, it's kind of the social epicenter of what's going on. And anyway, so you know, I'm constantly there. And I, you know, when I was young, I thought, well, I sang in church and you kind of fall in love with the idea of being a preacher and that kind of thing. And I had a pastor come in when I was probably, about 9 or 10. And he really kind of took me under his wing. And I remember he had a guitar and I was like, oh, I want to play guitar. So I learned to play guitar and sing and he never let me do lead. He never let me sing lead, which was really frustrating. But he's, I guess, you know, later on, I think he's trying to teach me humility, which, you know, is not a bad lesson, but I just thought I couldn't sing. And, so he kind of took me under his wing. And then when I got, he kind of was training me to be a pastor. And so I would ever so often, you know, you wouldn't get the main event Sunday morning, but you'd get maybe a Wednesday night or Sunday night, and he'd let me preach. And I really kind of fell in love with it. I wasn't, you know, disciplined, but I knew the performance aspect of it really well. I could keep an audience's attention, and you started kind of learning how to read an audience, how to prepare for those things. And so I kind of fell in love with it. And I thought, so I was about 18, 19, I thought, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of life. The whole goal was to be a singer or to be a preacher, not a singer at all. No, I wasn't. Well, I didn't want to be a singer. I never thought I was good enough to be a singer. And and then, you know, I fell in love with that. And then about 18, 19, you know, your worldview kind of expands. And I kind of fell out of love with it a bit. And so bizarrely enough, I grew a lot of venom for the church, you know, in general. And at the time I was living with my dad and me and two other people in a two bedroom apartment and couldn't keep the lights on, couldn't keep anything. It wasn't fun. But I was working at a construction company as a gopher, at a mechanic shop. And then when the economy crashed, lost my job. And then was unemployed for a year and a half. And then that's really met a beautiful girl who's now my wife. And really that year and a half where things started changing, I'd always kind of played music outside doing open mics, never really a band thing. I didn't have a lot of friends. And then basically I went back to school. I was getting my accounting degree, working as a part-time, got a job as a part-time bank teller. Or actually first got a job at a sporting goods store selling little kids' shoes, which was awful. And then, got his job as a part-time bank teller, was in accounting school. And then what's crazy is my best buddy who me and him started this band together. We got together kind of as our last hurrah because we were all getting big boy jobs. I was about done with accounting school and he was kind of doing his thing. And we, first song we wrote was a song called Broken Bones and Pocket Change. And that changed my life. You know, I'm a musician for a living now, and it's a crazy journey, man. It's a crazy journey.
Oh, that's incredible. And one of the things, I don't know if you've ever thought about this, and maybe you have, but when I first read kind of about your journey from, you know, kind of a desire to become a preacher all the way through like the hardships into becoming a musician, it's funny because not only are you kind of known for kind of this throwback soul style, you know, that was, you know, kind of born and bred out of, you know, like the 1950s, 1960s, but a lot of musicians who I grew up listening to and really look up to kind of had similar, you know, paths. You know, if you think about like Jerry Lee Lewis or like, Marvin Gaye, you know, a lot of these guys grew up also singing in the church and had very religious upbringing. So just kind of interesting, you know, that you parallel that in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, in church, especially the kind of church I grew up with, there's a sense of urgency. You know, you think you're singing for a higher cause, you know what I mean? And
yeah.
And it's a passion. And so what's interesting for me is now, you know, I don't really practice any sort of, you know, I don't really go to church much. My wife's Episcopalian, but I'd be lying if I said I was, you know, in the church doors every time they open. But I think what's interesting for me now is that that passion, that sense of urgency you pick up in church, it somehow leaks its way into what I do now. And it's a really interesting career path. But I think that's what you pick up there. You know, you pick up that kind of like, man, this is going to be the last time I sing, you know. Yeah. I'm singing to stay out of hell, you know? And,
yeah.
And you kind of sing that way. And I still sing that way. It's just, I don't, you know, necessarily feel that way now. I to stay out of debt, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh man. What was there to kind of go back to what you said when you kind of became disillusioned with you know, your faith, religion, whatever, was there anything specific that really, that really said, you know what, I don't know if this is going to be the career for me, or was it just kind of an accumulation of conversation or things over time?
There was a few things. There was accumulation. You know, growing up in small town Alabama, I didn't particularly love the view that the church I grew up in had like homosexuality. I thought it was absolutely, I didn't read that. You know what I mean? Like for me, because to be full disclosure, I'm a pretty liberal guy. And what's always been bizarre to me, to how I got there though, was through church. And I know people go, that's, you know, but for me, it was one of those things where you talk about love and acceptance and those kinds of things. Like that's what I was drawn to.
Yes.
And so
yeah.
I was having this kind of crisis of faith where I was just like, I don't understand. Like I got, you know, I was going to high school with kids who were gay and I couldn't understand why, you know what I mean? The good
yeah.
folk. I couldn't wrap my mind around it. And then, you know, then I had a pastor tell me that Gandhi went to hell, and I was like, man, if
like,
Gandhi went to hell, we're... Yeah, I'm like, golly, he went to hell. We got along. I mean, you know, and
we're all in trouble.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so really wrestling with that. And what's bizarre is that I developed a ton of venom for the church. I mean, just a ton.
Yeah.
Where I just, you know, I couldn't church people, you know, all of it. It's just, it was so venomous. And what's really beautiful is that my wife is, didn't grow up the same way I did. She grew up in a religious family, but they were just more chill, I guess.
Yeah.
Is the best way to put it. And so she was just like, you know, and once you start realizing, you know, and I do some nonprofit work and in the South, especially, you're going to have to work with churches. And one of those things is that you just have to, you know, it's an imperfect system. It was man-made. Religion, it's a man-made thing. But if you look at the essence of most religions and you look at the essence of it, you really go, okay, that's what it's about. And you just kind of, now I'm, you know, I'm a lot more accepting. And, you know, while I disagree with, you know, I don't think religion should be in politics. Religion's been in politics since religion's been around. So
sure.
It's kind of like, you know, it's so, but for me, it was, I'm at a much better place now than I was, you know, probably when I was probably 21 years old. Because there was a lot of venom, and it's just like, man, you just can't live your life that way. You know, there are things that bother me. Obviously, there's things that bother me about the church and all those things. But now I'm in a pretty good space.
That's great, man. Yeah, it's funny because everything that you just said, I think, probably echoes pretty familiar, pretty true to a lot of our listeners. Who came from, you know, would probably similar backgrounds to you in terms of more of a conservative fundamental background. And at some point we're just like, wait a minute, like, aren't we supposed to be a little more loving to our neighbors and the people around us? Like,
yeah. Why do we not emphasize that?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I don't, that's what bugs me is that I just, I'm like, man, like, because the reason I believe what I believe, the reason that I think, you know, the reason I have my views of homosexuality, of all of these things that are apparently somewhat taboo, is because of church, is because of getting to that point where you're like, love and acceptance, and that to me is, that to me is the essence. It's not punitive, you know, outcomes of everything. I think society in general is too punitive, you yeah. know, and there's not enough embracing. And I'm not, you know, it's to me, it gets a little hippy dippy, but for me, it's just most things. It's where I'm comfortable. And, you know, I just, yeah, no, it was always one of those things that just, I hated because, you know, man, I remember there's a terrible story, but I remember, you know, the kind of prosperity, you know, you have to have enough faith to
oh, yeah.
be healed. I remember there was a lady in our church who had cancer, and that she died thinking she didn't have enough faith to be healed.
Oh, geez.
And I just, exactly.
Oh,
to
man.
To me, that's wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
That's wrong. And so it's, you grapple with that stuff and yeah, but I mean, I'm, to be fair, like if I go with my wife to an Episcopal service, I really do find there's a peace still about it. You know what I mean? Like I listen to some of those old gospel tunes, there's still a peace about it. So I still find something there. I always tell people like if me and God had a Facebook status, it would be complicated. I mean, that would be, yeah. that would be the relationship status.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, it would be more like my relationship status with other Christians would be complicated. You know?
Yeah. Well, that's always complicated. Yeah. You know, you're talking to, that's always complicated. But at the same time, you know, my mom and dad are fairly conservative. And they're good people. You know, they're good people. It's just they believe different things. And we try not to talk about them at Thanksgiving. You know, that's kind of it just ruins Thanksgiving that happens.
Yeah. Yep. A lot of people can understand that, right? So
it's like, please don't let mom talk.
Yeah.
Please, you know, like let's get through it.
It's like my extended family in politics. We just steer clear of that topic altogether. You know,
just steer clear of it. Let's not talk about it. Let's enjoy each other's company and go on.
Exactly. Oh man. So you talked about, you know, going to school and you're going for accounting, which by the way, you guys should never go broke, right? Cause you have no excuse. Cause you have this accounting background.
Exactly.
So you guys should be well invested.
Well, the problem is that we have a business manager now cause I would try to handle it and it gets too big to where you have to let someone else handle it. The problem is the business manager and booking agents are not used to an artist calling them up and saying, hey, I'm looking at these numbers and I'm just trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
And part of them really loves that I care a lot about that stuff or that I ask questions, but part of them are like, just let me do my job. Okay. Just leave me alone. But it does happen.
Well, at the very least, we'll know that you'll never have a Billy Joel moment where you'll open up a safety deposit box and there's just a stack of IOUs in there. So that's good. Your bandmate should feel comfortable.
If that happens, something has gone. Somebody's lying somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So you're going to school to be an accountant, and you said that your friends, you know, who you'd been playing with, were all kind of, you know, getting ready to get together and maybe do this one, as you said, last hurrah before you go on and do your regular full-time jobs and that sort of thing. At what point when you guys sat down, was it when you were recording? Was it when you started to play live shows that you started to realize, whoa, wait a minute, we've got something special here?
Really for me, I knew what was crazy is that people that had heard it started getting really interested. Like asking us like, hey, you know, they wanted to be a part of it.
Yeah.
And that's when I started to kind of know, okay, there's something here. And so that's really when we decided, all right, we got to see it through. You know what I mean? Like go do the thing, you know, try to tour, that kind of thing. But what's crazy is that, I mean, I knew there was a song we had, Broken Bones, Pocket Change, which is like, to me, it's kind of the essence that's the essence of the band. You know, yeah. it to me, that's kind of the launching pad for the band. I remember writing that song, me and Jesse doing that song and being like, there's something here. I don't know what it is. I don't know. I mean, in our mind, like, we're from Birmingham, Alabama. Okay. So, I mean, we're living in Birmingham. So there hasn't been a ton of bands of modern times that have exploded out of Birmingham. Okay. So it was at the time that we were there, like, it was kind of the death kiss to be from the city of Birmingham. Now, luckily, a band like the Alabama Shakes and some of these other bands have started to kind of emerge, not from our city, but from our state. And so it started not to have such a stigma with it. But man, I mean, it kind of snowballed. It was one of those bizarre things where you're just like, you kind of caught lightning in the bottle a little bit. You know, the moment people started showing interest, you're like, whoa, okay, maybe we should take this seriously we started playing shows and, you know, I remember one time we played like 7 times in the city of Birmingham within a month or something, a month and a half, which is a big no-no. You don't do that. Like, but what was happening is every time we were playing, more people were coming. And by the end of it, we were selling out, you know, 250 cab rooms in Birmingham. And we thought, oh no, this is pretty serious. And so it just kind of, it was a snowball effect. And then we, got involved with a record label in Florence that had John Paul of the Civil Wars and Ben Tanner, who plays with the Shakes, and a guy named Will Trapp, Single Lock Records up in Florence. And then they said, we will pay for studio time for you to make a record. And we thought, well, this is the big time, fellas. We've done it. Someone is willing to pay for us to go to the studio. So we had like 3 or 4 days in the studio. And then around that time, the biggest thing that happened to us, we got a manager named Tracy Thomas, who does Jason Isbell, and I think now does John Moreland. When she got involved, it changed. I mean, it was an instant change. And then we got a great booking agent, and it was a High Road booking. And it just, that, honestly, man, like, that, all of that happened so quickly that it was just like, whoa, what happened? and so it's really hard to be like, oh, that's the moment. But you just kind of stuck at it, and people seemed to like it. So it just kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the first time I came into contact with your music, I was, just flipping through Spotify. And I think at one point, if I remember correctly, they had, some live tracks from your performance. I think it was at South by Southwest or something like that.
Yeah. 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 That is one of my least favorite recordings of us.
No way.
Because I could barely talk.
Oh my gosh. I remember thinking, whoa, who is this guy and where is this voice coming from?
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah. I mean, that hooked me. Immediately after that, I went out and found your first record and was like, oh my gosh, like, who are these guys? You know? So.
Well, that's good to hear, because I'm not kidding. I could barely talk. And what's great, we had done about 9 shows in 3 days or something crazy like that.
Oh my gosh.
And I could barely talk at that show. It's good to know that did some good, because I was like, I don't know if I want that out there for the public. But what's really beautiful about that is I did A Change Is Gonna Come with Lizzo on that. And it's that song, for that one instant, I could hit everything I needed to hit. And I was like, so it was kind of a magical.
Wow.
I mean, it was a magic. It's one of those rare kind of, like, you're like, whoa. I mean, I get chills thinking about it, because it was magical how it just kind of came back. And yeah. Yeah, man, that's good to know. Yeah, that was, but that was a rough performance.
I would have never guessed, honestly.
Good. All right.
Yeah, I would have never guessed. See, now we'll edit that part out, that way no one knows, you know. I'm kidding. We barely edit anything. Yeah.
Hey, you're good.
Yeah. So, one of the things I read that I thought was super interesting, cuz by the way, the new record is just unbelievable. I think if I could like it better than the first one, it's, you know, I thought that would be impossible, but it's just from start to finish, it's just an amazing album.
Well, thank you.
And one of the things I read that I thought was really interesting, Adam and I are both huge, huge readers, read everything we can get our hands on. And what I had read, you can tell me, correct me if this is true or not, but a lot of the mood of the new album is based off of a book that you were reading called Just Mercy.
So what
kind of impact did that have on this album? What was the book about, first of all, I guess?
Well, the book is by a guy named Brian Stevenson, who he started a nonprofit called the Equal Justice Initiative. It's based in Montgomery, Alabama. And basically it was, you know, kind of talking about how basically like a lot of after the civil rights movement, you know, people of color in the South especially, there were still laws being put in place that were putting a lot of innocent people on death row, or just it's basically people who are not able to afford proper, let's say, legal representation. You know, it's a nonprofit that has, you know, Harvard educated lawyers, all of these kind of top lawyer schools, where they basically are funded through donations to represent death row inmates, to represent just all sorts of situations. So it kind of talks about his journey doing that. It's a beautiful story. It's a beauty. And I've read inspirational books. Don't get me wrong. Like I've read them. I've read a lot of nonfiction, and it was just one of those, it hit me at a certain time in my life where I was like, I was no longer not making any money. You know what I mean? I was in a weird spot where I was like, there's starting to become a tension and you're starting to kind of get these things and you're start going, all right, what am I going to do with my life? Like, do I want this music thing to be the thing that defines me, that people go look back? And I was like, no, I don't. And so I had this crisis where I thought about stop playing, stop singing, and really kind of devote my life, still that call of like doing service, you know, like doing something that was kind of beyond, because you do music and yes, you make people happy and you really do, you can do some good. But you also get your name screened. You know what I mean? Like people cheer for you. There's very instant gratification.
Yeah.
And so there's this tug of balance where you're just kind of like, you want to like disappear and like do something that doesn't get a lot of attention and really like really service oriented. And I still had that desire. And so I read that book and it just kind of, you know, it just kind of hits you to where you have that tug. Where you're like, man, I really need to be doing something with my life. Cause you know, I mean, at the time, I hadn't worked a job over minimum wage, you know, and so it's hard to do what you can, but it's just hard to live that way and be donating money, you know, or to be doing, you know, because you're just trying to, you just really live in paycheck to paycheck. And, you know, when that changed, I was like, I had this crisis a bit, and I was in my bed, I read it, and with my wife, and I'm just bawling, and she's worried about me. She's like, you know, I had like letters drafted to every band member and to the manager.
Oh,
basically,
no way.
Like, say, yeah, I mean, I cannot emphasize enough how like close it was. I think I would probably have eventually gone back to it. But it was really this crisis within me because, you know, I don't desire this attention. You know, it's not something, I love playing music and I love letting that be my creative outlet, but there's just something to me that's still kind of tugging with service. So anyway, I don't do that, but I talked to my wife and we talked for a while and I was like, with this next record, I really have to say something and really, you know, be more conscious about what I'm doing and really kind of, you know, and then on a personal level, you know, start working with, you know, charitable things, start doing some service, you know, doing those things to really kind of, I guess, fill in that hole that I felt was there now. And so that's really how the record was kind of spawned. It was spawned from that sense of service, sense of urgency to do something and kind of exploring Southern identity in these modern times. And, you know, which is, you know, my background in church and things like that. So it's not a story I tell often, because it's not something that, you know, I think it scared everybody.
Yeah.
You know, you know, they're like, oh God, You know, we've got careers. But I guess that's kind of my thing, is that's the kind of impact it had.
Yeah.
And you come across, and like I said, it was just one of those stories, and that book had such a profound impact on me.
Oh man, that's incredible. When I read that, I thought about, there's a book I picked up randomly. I saw, I think, a trailer for a documentary that's coming out soon, about this figure, this public figure who was, kind of on par with Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X around that same time period, named James Baldwin.
And yeah, James Baldwin. Yeah.
I'd never heard of the guy. And I was like, who is this guy? So I went out and picked up one of his books, and I'm telling you, it's not even that long, but this thing has floored me since the minute I started reading the first page. It's just incredibly well written, and just, I imagine, you know, I probably feel a lot the same, you know, as when you were reading that particular book, just in the way that it's moved me to, you know, to open up that conversation a little bit more. And I think, I think that's great. I think that's amazing use of your platform. I think that's awesome. So
Yeah. It's especially here in the South, you know, especially things with race and things like that. There's, especially in Birmingham. I mean, we have those issues, and I think sometimes it's difficult for us to talk about. But the problem is that everybody's afraid to talk about it. And I don't, that you got to be able to talk. We got to have open dialogue about this stuff, because, you know, and what's beautiful about our state is that they're starting to recognize, you know, they're starting to put markers at the lynchings in our state.
Wow.
It's starting to be a state site, and the Equal Justice Initiative is a big part of that. But that's really important, because, you know, you're acknowledging this history, and it's very sad and it's very awful history, but it's being acknowledged, and it's for so long it hasn't been in our state. And it's just like, which is crazy, you know, it's just kind of like, oh, let's just sweep it under the rug. And it's to me, that's, you can't heal wounds that no one acknowledges.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, and so it's a really, I'm, you know, that it's a process, and it'll always be a process.
Yeah.
But I feel like there's some progress being made, especially in our state, which is remarkable.
Wow, that's great, man. To stay on kind of the same topic, one of the things that I had heard you mention before in another interview was just kind of this internal struggle that you've had with Birmingham and with living there. And I think you had mentioned at one point that you'd even considered moving away, you know, and kind of putting it behind you, but then finding some sort of peace and redemption in staying there. And I could be wrong, but it seems to me that the song "Is It Me?" may or may not be about that.
it's definitely got elements of that. It definitely does. It's a, it's also, it's also, based on a sci-fi novel. I think called A Childhood's End. That actually, this is a big plot detail, but the whole book is about, these beings come to Earth and basically make Earth like a utopia, but they won't reveal themselves for 70 years.
Oh, wow.
And then when they finally, reveal themselves, and no one could understand why they wouldn't reveal themselves. So they finally reveal themselves, and they look like our version of Satan, of a devil.
Oh, no.
And so it's a really interesting, but they've caused this utopian society for Earth and done all of these great things. Now the book goes further than that, and it turns out to not be so great, but it was just the idea of what we see as evil and bad imagery, especially, you know, from my background, and turning that up on its head. Cause there's a line in there that, "Devils, won't you take me up with you? And I could use the company, and I'm sure you could use it too." And so it's basically a mixture of those things. And so, to me, that's honestly, man, like it's been really fun. We just got back from Europe and everybody knew the lyrics of that song. And it was just like, it's a really cool moment for me, because I do, there is definitely coping and with all of that. And that's definitely one of the main songs I think about for that.
Jesus is stuck inside my TV screen, giving all the answers, but never holding me. Heaven's too far away, and I can't find no peace. Is it hell, is it home, or is it me?
Oh, that's great. Yeah, that's got to be a weird experience the first time you hear thousands of people, you know, reciting your own lyrics back to you, right?
It's very intimidating. You're like, oh God, why did I write that? you know, but it can be fascinating.
Yeah. So if you had a goal going forward, obviously you're very in tune with what's happening around you in your society, in the world, in the country, you know, and that impacts the way that you write and the way that you sing and perform and the way that you do service, you know, for your community. What hope do you have in terms of like what do you hope for people to take away from your music?
Music wise, I mean, really, I hope that it can inspire creativity, thought, and then also, you know, being able to, you know, and having. I don't want it ever to be taken too seriously, because at the end of the day, it's music. And yes, it can change. It has powers. But for me, it's one of those things like, you know, I hope that like when I want people to get, you know, all the goodness out of it they can. Because there's probably people that listen to the new record and don't understand some of the context that is being used, and they just kind of groove to it. And that's okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's fine by me. But I, you know, there are people that probably listen to it and go, oh, that's a little bit deeper than you really want it to unite people, bring people together, and kind of, you know, have these moments where you're like, oh yeah, we can agree on music, or, you know, we can, you know what I mean? And like,
yeah.
But I mean, and very selfishly, it's just a creative outlet for me that really scratches this need that I have to release music and to put it out in the public view. You know, it varies, man. I just want people to really, for a concert, it's really beautiful when everybody can come together and have one moment with one song or one show. I think that's a beautiful thing. And to be able to be lucky enough to do that in front of people and maybe be the conduit that makes that happen is it's a really beautiful thing. And it's like, if you could bottle it up, man, you know, I'd never leave home, but you can't. I just, you know, I think this good times, unity, you know, makes you laugh, makes you cry, makes you go. But, you know, at the end of the day, it gives you some sort of release.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the thing that at least I know Adam and I love about just a really good live show is, you know, when the band's feeling it and when they're into it and the crowd just kind of, when you kind of lose yourself in the moment, you know, you kind of forget about time and space and where you are and what you're dealing with. And you're just there in that moment. And, there's something magical about that, you know, that you don't necessarily find in other art forms, you know?
Right. Well, I mean, for me, I'm a huge, like, I love, especially when in Europe, I go see a painting. I've always wanted to see, and it varies. Sometimes you don't have that moment, but sometimes you do. And it's very much to me like a show, in that you have this collective moment of beauty where you're having a moment, but there might be somebody next to you that's having a similar kind of moment. Maybe you're getting different things out of it. And it doesn't happen all the time, but I've had a few of those, because I mean, to me, I'm more inspired by art than I am music. Which is a very bizarre thing.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's very bizarre. When I go, you know, there's a really famous painting called The Death of Marat, and I saw it in Brussels, and I remember having this beautiful moment with it, and I remember thinking, golly, like, this is hard. This just inspires you. and inspires you to, you know, because it was about the French Revolution and all of these things. And I'm actually my bandmates say, I actually secretly am like a sophisticated redneck, is what they call it.
That's great.
Yeah, that's kind of. So I love art. It's a bizarre, but for me, you know, I can get the same thing from seeing a painting that I can't. It's a different thing, but it's to me art in general, however you define that, whether it's painting or music, it's the only thing that to me can make you think, it can make you smile, it can make you cry, it can make you have these moments. And I think in society today in general, with social media, we can be so detached.
Yeah.
Yet connected. It's this weird thing, but to me, live music is still the tried and true. Seeing something in person is just the tried and true connection with another human being. And that's, you know, you can't replicate that. You just can't. And that's why I don't think live music will ever die, is because, or going to see paintings will ever die, or going to see, you know, theater will not die, because that is, we all search for that.
Yeah.
No matter who we are, no matter what our belief system is, we all search for that, whatever it is.
Man, I could not agree more with that. Oh, man. So just got a couple more questions for you. One of the things I thought was probably had been a cool moment in your life is there's a quote by, let me see if I can find the exact quote here. I have it written down, but Keith Richards was quoted as saying that you're a cat that can do Otis Redding. Now, to me, Otis Redding might be, if not the greatest vocalist of all time, at least in the conversation. You know, that's got to be a weird moment when a legend like Keith Richards tells you sound like Otis Redding. Come on.
Well, he's incorrect. That is sacrilege. You know, that is not, it's unbelievably flattering. I don't think it's true. I think that there is no one who is Otis Redding. But what's been bizarre. Yeah. I mean, that's been bizarre. I mean, with, you know, having people like Keith Richards and people like that who, are fans of what you do is scary. It's a weird experience, but I didn't grow up listening to the Rolling Stones. So yeah. Bizarrely enough, it was not one of those things. Like I, bizarrely, the most starstruck I've ever been was a professional wrestler.
I got to know who was it.
It was Jerry the King Lawler. This is crazy. So I was in, This shows how like messed up my priorities are. is that I was stateside watching Jerry Lee Lewis play.
Oh,
okay,
man.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Come on now.
Exactly. I mean, a legend, no doubt.
Absolutely.
But I was standing next to Jerry Lawler, and I could not talk to the man. My wife was laughing. I mean, I've met with Elton John, the Rolling Stones, all these people. And the one person that just I could not talk to was Jerry the King Lawler.
Wow.
And my wife thought it was the funniest thing she has ever seen. So what's bizarre about all that is that, yes, I'm flattered, and it's awesome. It's just weird that I like the rest of the – because I went to go hang out when we opened up for the Stones. I went to go hang out with those guys and with Keith and Ronnie and Charlie. And saw Mick for a little bit, you know, very briefly. But they were all like super nice, and you know, it's a big deal, but at the same time, you're like, I mean, they put their pants on the same way you do. Like because we're nowhere even close to the Stones at all, but you are in the same business.
Sure. Sure.
And so you kind of, it's weird. Like you, to me, it's always kind of like this brotherly, sisterly thing in the music business. Like anybody to me who plays a real instrument and is doing it, I might not like their music, but I'm going to pull for them as long as they're not good folks.
Right.
And so it's weird. It's different. So I'm unbelievably flattered Actually, to me, the Otis stuff, though, the most flattering thing is that his family has embraced us unbelievably. They invited us to the Big O Ranch, which is where, you know, down in Macon, and we went to go there. And there has only been only a couple bands to go there. And we were, that's where Otis is buried, is on his property. And Zelma, his widow, is just a wonderful human being. The whole family is wonderful. We actually we played his 75th birthday party in Macon. His family asked. It was a charity event, and we don't usually do things like that because it just it was right during our record, our Sea of Noise record release. So it was just a really bad timing. But because Zelma asked, we were like, I will never tell that woman no.
Yeah.
She was one of the very few people I will never tell no to. But they've just embraced us. She sent us this beautiful letter that I've gotten framed. That was, it was one of the most flattering things. I mean, it was just, it was amazing. And so that to me, if people hate on you, you just have to think about that and be like, man, how many people have gotten a letter like that?
No kidding.
You know, and how many people have gotten a letter like that? That like basically saying like, I haven't seen an artist since my husband be able to, you know, capture that spirit.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, exactly.
Now, did you play?
I'm just thinking about it.
Did you play Burning Rome for that show?
Actually, we did Otis songs.
Oh, you did? Okay.
We did A Change Is Gonna Come.
Oh,
and,
man.
And we did. And what's crazy, one of our all-time favorites, a guy named William Bell, he's an old soul singer out of Memphis. He wrote one of my favorite all-time soul songs called I Forgot to Be Your Lover. He was at the event, and I got to sit back and watch the band play that song with him that night. And, man, it was just an incredible night. It was a crazy night, but it was, we did Otis songs. I mean, we used to, when this band was first cutting its teeth, we would do whole Otis Redding records because our record hadn't come out yet. So we had to fill in time. So we did it. We would do Otis Blue. And then we would do, one time we did The Exciting Wilson Pickett. and what's really funny is about a lot of those records is the Otis Blue one is not, there's really no filler on that record. The Exciting Wilson Pickett, there's some filler on that record. So it was a lot of fun to get to do that live. And, but we used to do that all the time, and that's how this band cut its teeth. Really, a lot of ways is doing that.
Oh, man.
Doing those shows.
Well, we got to get you guys to come and do a show in Columbus, Ohio, and maybe we can kind you into doing These Arms or something like that. That would be pretty incredible.
We used to end the show with I've Been Loving You Too Long.
Oh, jeez.
And it would, man, I do it during a sound check now. We don't do it in the show anymore because we got a song, you know, we got some songs that I think they're not as good, but they do the same kind of thing. And, anyway, but we do it for sound check every once in a while and just to get me, just cause it keeps me happy. It's a good song to do.
Oh man. Yeah. Those songs never get old.
They never get old, man.
Well, man, I just appreciate your time. I'm so bummed Adam couldn't be here tonight, and I know he's pretty bummed too. But he's also in Florida, so I don't feel all that bad for him. But,
nah, man, he's enjoying the weather for sure.
Before I let you go, what is the best place for people? I know there's going to be some people out there who may not have heard of your music, but who are hopefully hearing some clips of it throughout this episode, who are definitely going to want to go check it out. What's the best place to go get your records? What's the best place to keep on keep in touch with what you guys are up to, tour dates and that sort of thing?
Well, we're terrible at social media. I've started to really use Instagram a little bit. I mean, man, we got a website, you know, it's stpaulandthebrokenbones.com. Like you go there, Facebook. I mean, we got it already, Facebook. The only thing we don't have Snapchat yet. But we got I mean, you can buy it on iTunes or whatever. I don't know. I mean, I'm a great salesman, as you can tell. You know, plugging it hard. But I mean, we got a website, Facebook, whatever. I mean, it's just St. Paul, ST. Paul and Broken Bones.
Perfect. Well, we'll definitely get all the links and stuff in our show notes so people can go there and pick up the new album and all of your previous work. And again, like I said, man, we were looking forward to this so much. Even though we don't know you, I can just tell, like, you just come across like a really, really good guy who really takes this gift seriously, and you're doing the best you can with it. So again, I just appreciate you taking time out of your schedule. I know you guys have been definitely very busy lately. So
yeah, no, thank you, man. I'm glad we could finally make it work. I know there's been a few rescheduling things. I think one was in Europe.
Yeah.
And I was like, I forgot I was going to be in Europe. And I sent somebody, I was like, don't let him call me in Europe. He can't afford that phone bill. I can't afford that phone bill. So we'll have to reschedule.
Hey, it worked out.
Yeah, no, it was a pleasure, man. Thank you.
Yeah, well, we appreciate it. And we'll have to do it again sometime when you guys have another record out. That'd be a lot of fun.
Awesome, man. Thank you. Yeah, of course.
John, what just happened?
Adam, you look a little groggy. I think you fell asleep, man.
Is the interview over?
Yeah, sorry. He's gone.
What did you talk about?
You know, music and stuff. Yeah, you look really well rested, though.
I have a headache.
That'll go away. It's okay.
So was it good? Was it a good interview?
It was pretty solid, man. He's a good guy.
Man, what'd you cover? I mean, I'll have to listen to it.
Oh, man. Just a really cool, really interesting backstory on his life and some of the struggles that he had with some of the viewpoints that the church had in relation to other people, around the world, and just kind of how narrow-minded and just unloving that we can be, and how that kind of indirectly led him into the work that he does now. Like, the guy was going to go to school to be an accountant.
I'm so glad he did not become an accountant.
I know. I did tease him about the fact that I'm like, you guys should never go broke then, right? Because you're doing all the bookkeeping.
Yeah. You know why I'm so glad you got him on is because, like you said in the intro, information and theory is not what this is all supposed to be about, even though we, those are a lot of the books and the authors and the people that we end up getting on here. And hopefully that speaks into all you listeners and all your stories out there. But story is very important. And getting to hear Paul's story, like you just did, John, is also very important for all you listeners that just got to hear not just facts, not just figures, not just theory, but story. We need to try to do that more. And we're going to try to find ways to do that.
Yeah, we always try to keep it interesting by throwing in some random episodes that maybe don't quite, fit with the general theme of like academia and that sort of thing.
Totally.
But just really interesting stories, and we hope to continue to be able to do that and keep the variety going. And we hope you enjoyed it, and we hope you enjoyed the music.
Yeah, who's the musical cast?
St. Paul and the Broken. You know, it'd be funny is if we had him on and then just put some other soul band on. I would not do that. They were too good. They not only let us use their music, but they were like, "Can you use music from both albums?" And I'm like,
"Heck yes,
yes, please." So there's tunes, tracks from both albums. Go out and get them. Tweet at them, tell them we sent you, and just enjoy it, man. It is heartfelt, just really, really honest music about some dark topics and some dark struggles that we're all going through, and just from this band, just their way of kind of processing that and using their position to do some good.
So, absolutely, man. Absolutely.
Hope you enjoyed it.
Thanks, John. Yeah. Thanks for acting as as my proxy.
You were here in spirit. I had a picture, I had a picture of you and Joel Osteen sitting next to me the yep. entire time I recorded.
It's a good picture. I loved it when I got to meet old Papa Joel.
Yeah. Yep.
It was a beautiful day for me. For all of you deconstructionists out there, whatever it is you're going through, hopefully this episode was healing. Just getting to hear a story, and hopefully you're continuing on and being present in your stories. We love that you can be with us, and hopefully you got a break from Adam this week.
They missed you. What are you talking about?
Until next time, everybody, we are your hosts. I am Adam Narlock.
And I'm John Williamson.
Keep deconstructing, everyone.